My friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. Also, I'm a contributor to antiwar.com. And my first guest today is Llewellyn H. Rockwell, Jr. He is the protege of the late Murray N. Rothbard, is the founder and president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and vice president of the Center for Libertarian Studies. He's the author of the books Free Market Reader, Essays in the Economics of Liberty, The Gold Standard, Perspectives in the Austrian School, The Irrepressible Rothbard, and Speaking of Liberty, a collection of speeches. His personal website, lourockwell.com, hosts the writings of the best libertarian thinkers, including Lou himself, Murray Rothbard, Walter Block, Mark Thornton, Bob Murphy, Butler Schaefer, Tibor McCann, Anthony Gregory, Karen Katowski, Ron Paul, Lawrence M. Vance, Robert T. Long, Joseph Stromberg, Brad Edmonds, Stephen Yates, Mike in Tokyo Rogers, Ralph Rako, Wendy McElroy, and Stephen Kinsella. Welcome to the show, Lou.
Scott, great to be with you.
It's great to have you on, sir. Well, we have quite a few things to talk about today, the storm, the war, trade, the Constitution. But I want to start off with, who was Ludwig von Mises, and why did you name your institute after him?
Mises was one of the great, I think one of the great minds of the modern era, certainly the greatest economist of the 20th century, a man who wrote 25 books and hundreds of important articles, and was really the key economist and philosopher of capitalism and the free society. Mises was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, educated at the University of Vienna, and always a very radical figure, a supporter of laissez-faire capitalism and classical liberalism, and I guess best known for the fact that he was the first economist ever to demonstrate, we're talking shortly after the Russian Revolution, that communism, socialism, would have to be a poverty-producing, chaotic disaster. Because if there is no private property in the means of production, that is, if the state owns the factories and the other means of production, there's no way for anybody to know what to produce. Should you have a shoe factory in Smolensk, or should you have a sock factory? How many pairs of what kind of shoes should you produce? There's no way to know anything. And so he showed that that under socialism, the only way they could exist at all was by watching foreign prices, which indeed is the way the Soviet Union lasted as long as it did. But he was the first one to show that socialism, and indeed any form of government intervention in the economy, hurts our prosperity, hurts our freedom, and because private property and the division of labor and the social cooperation that come out of the market are the foundations of civilization, socialism, communism, Nazism, fascism, the welfare state, the New Deal, compassionate conservatism, any of these names for the big state, are also decivilizing. So it's the struggle against them, really there's nothing more important on this earth.
And I get the idea from reading your book, Speaking of Liberty, that for a time there, Mises was basically all by himself defending free markets when everyone else was one form of socialist or another.
Well, he had a very tough time all his life, and I must say, you know, it never stopped him. I mean, he was a hero. Not only was he a great intellectual and a great scholar, and as I say, economist, a political philosopher, a historian, but he never let anything stop him. So that he kept fighting, and no matter what obstacles he had up against, he kept going, and really a great role model, if you'll excuse the expression, for any of us concerned about human liberty.
All right, everybody, I'm talking with Lou Rockwell. He's the founder and president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and we'll be right back.
Yeah.
friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Lou Rockwell from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Lou, what's praxeology?
Well, praxeology was Mises' word for his method, really the method of economics for most of the time of the existence of economics until the 20th century. Or the end of the 19th century, and it's a logical deductive method. Mises held that all of economics could be deduced logically and from just one single insight that man acts. That is, that which is something we know by introspection. We know that we set out to achieve goals. We undertake things in order to bring other things about. And from that very, and by the way, mainstream economics denies that there's a purpose of action. One of the many things wrong with Keynesianism and the rest of mainstream economics. This is the same methodology that really Adam Smith had, that the late scholastics, who were the founders of economics, Kantian, Turgot, all the great economists who lived in the past, did economics this way. Today, mainstream economics is based on positivism, and it's the view that you can't really know anything for sure, and that economics is not a deductive logical science, but is instead something involving mathematics. And so, praxeology is—I guess we can just—it's a commonsensical way of looking at the world and understanding the way we interact with each other and with the world to achieve our goals. And it also helps us understand why government, which of course is a gun at your head, I mean, that's what government is, they put a gun at your head and they order you to do something, why this is anti-economic as well as a problem otherwise.
So if I was to go and take Economics 101 at the local college, and they're going to sit me down with a textbook full of math equations and all that kind of stuff, that's not how Austrian economics works, with different curves and divide by five and all that?
No, it's entirely literary economics, which is not to say that, I mean, math is a beautiful science, and it's obviously an extremely important science. We would just argue that it doesn't have much to do with human action, unlike, say, physics, where mathematics is essential to understanding the action or the movement of non-purposive things like atoms or molecules or the wind or the sun, the stars, and so forth. But when we're talking about human beings, Austrians would argue that we have to have a different methodology, one that recognizes, again, that we undertake purposive action, that we have purposes, that we seek to achieve these purposes to the best of our ability all during our lives.
So the difference really is individualism. Mises' premise being man acts as opposed to men act.
Well, yeah, and they don't even believe men act, but it's absolutely true that it's methodological individualism, that it sees the key way of analyzing the economy, and of course it has other implications too, as being the individual. That this, the individual is the, obviously, there is no such thing. I mean, there are groups, there are companies, there are societies exist and so forth, but everything is composed of individuals. Society is not a separate organic, as various kinds of statists would hold, that it has some kind of organic existence apart from the individuals composing it. We would say, and obviously this is, as libertarians, we say this too, that it is the individual who is the building block of society, and it is individuals who form families, individuals who form churches, individuals who form businesses, and neighborhoods, schools, and of course all of society.
Now, you mentioned before in your description of Austrian economics that basically Austrians hold that any government intervention in the market only leads to worse problems down the road and that kind of thing. And I think probably the, as far as I know, the best argument against that would be the boom and bust business cycle, and that markets go crazy with speculation, and that you have to have police power to sort of smooth out the booms and busts and keep the economic course of the country basically smooth.
Well, that certainly is, you know, the mainstream view, and Keynes expressed it by saying, by likening the economy to a truck, and the government is the guy at the wheel. And if you didn't have the guy at the wheel, why gosh, the truck would veer off the road and crash. The Austrian view is that society is self-governing, that you do not need this external agent equipped with a gun ordering people around, that in fact it's entirely negative. And one example is the one you mentioned, the business cycle. We would hold that the business cycle, that is, booms and busts, are artificially created by, in our case, the central bank, the Federal Reserve System, by its inflation, by its increasing the supply of money and holding and bringing the interest rate lower than it would otherwise be, and causing all kinds of misallocations of investments and capital and bad decisions by businessmen that seem great during the boom. It seems like everything's going great during the boom. When the boom turns into a bust, all of a sudden these economic decisions that seem so smart turn out to have been very bad mistakes and have to be liquidated. So, of course, there can be, you know, there can be widespread economic, you know, the flooding in New Orleans has economic consequences regardless of what the Federal Reserve is doing. But you only get systemic errors by businessmen. Most businesses are profitable most of the time under normal circumstances. When you find systemic losses, systemic mistakes, then you have to look to the government, and specifically at Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, which is probably the, you know, certainly the most, outside of maybe the warfare state, certainly the most damaging thing the government does is its central bank and its manipulation of money and credit. And has all kinds of very bad economic effects, bad societal effects, just horrendous societal effects in terms of promoting the wrong kinds of conduct in society and rewarding the wrong kinds and penalizing the good kinds, penalizing savers and rewarding non-savers. This has horrendous effects, just like, of course, the welfare state. Hans Hoppe, who's one of our senior scholars and student of Murray Rothbard's, has written brilliantly on this in his book on Democracy, The God That Failed, and elsewhere, that we have, with the welfare state, we have all the worst, and Mises was actually the first one to write about this, all the worst things are stimulated and the good things are held back, so that people are stimulated not to save for their future, but to spend everything. Not to worry about their health, but to think, well, I'll be taken care of. The government's going to take care of me. I don't have to save for my future. I'm going to have Social Security. I don't have to worry about losing my job. On the margin, anyway, I'm going to get unemployment benefits. That all these things have not only very bad economic effects, but just bad cultural effects. That it changes the time horizon of society. And the more mature an individual, the more mature a society, the more people look to the future, the more they're concerned with the long term, their children, their grandchildren, even beyond their grandchildren. Whereas an immature society, an immature individual just wants it right now, got to have it right now. Boy, look at that beautiful watch in that jewelry store window. Well, I don't want to have to get a job and work and save in order to buy it. I'm going to smash and grab it right this moment. I don't care about anything except grabbing that watch. The welfare state stimulates that sort of thinking all across society, makes us less mature, and it has things to do with the interest rate and makes us poorer. I mean, the government is nothing but, Murray Rothbard called it a band of thieves and murderers writ large. And that's what it is. And it's a parasite living off the rest of us, doing horrendous damage to us. Although, as the great libertarian, 19th century libertarian Lysander Spooner said, there is a difference between the congressman and the highwayman. He said the highwayman doesn't make you call him the honorable.
Oh, yeah, I love Spooner. So, well, what about the welfare state for the rich people? I mean, you bring up unemployment benefits and that kind of thing. But I notice in reading Mises.org, I often find the term mercantilism, and it seems to be mostly used to describe welfare for people who have already made it.
Well, of course, it's true that I don't want to break anybody's civics class illusions, but the poor have no influence in Washington D.C. It's only the well-to-do, well-to-do and the powerful who have influence. Now, it's true that the poor may be used as an excuse. Hey, we got to help the poor. We got to have, you know, much more public housing. But it's the guys building the public housing, getting the Section 8 subsidies and so forth, who are actually moving things forward. When it's foreign aid, they may talk about, oh, poor people, starving people in Africa, and they need AIDS medicine, they need food, whatever. It's actually the companies in America that will get the money from the government to produce the various things that will be given to Africa who are lobbying for it and who have the influence. It's not poor people in Rwanda have any influence in Washington.
Right.
So it's true, it is, you know, and...
Sorry, we're going to have to hold it right there, Lou. Everybody, we'll be right back. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Lou Rockwell from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. His websites are Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and LouRockwell.com. That's L-E-W-Rockwell.com. And Lou, is it really the case that the nation state, the modern Western nation state, was basically created by the merchants to socialize their risk in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the nation state as we know it today is really a product of the 17th century and the results of the wars of religion and the Treaty of Westphalia and the continuing centralization process that had begun earlier when the kings wanted to bring all provinces that had been semi-independent under feudalism under their control and then get rid of any independent nobles who had any and free cities and that sort of thing and centralize everything under the central government. But with the 17th century and the results of the Reformation and the growth of nationalism and the love and philosophy of war, we, you know, got the nation state. So I think that part of it is the desire of the state itself and the state managers for power and glory. And that's all aspects of them, and whether it's the military aspect or the judicial or whatever aspect of the state. But, you know, the state is fundamentally stupid. Think of it as like some kind of giant, very powerful alligator with very sharp teeth, and, you know, if it grabs you, you're dead. On the other hand, it's not smart. Private businessmen, private economic interests, unfortunately, you know, are smart. That's good, but it's not good when they use this to the government to do things.
But what's the difference, Lou? I mean, don't really smart people go into government service for a living sometimes?
Yeah, there are very smart people in there, but the institution itself, the nature of bureaucracy and the nature of the state and the nature of an organization that's based on force and violence means it's fundamentally stupid. It's not a creative institution. It's a bludgeon. So it can be a very effective bludgeon, but you know the bludgeon is insufficient. It needs a brain, and unfortunately, the brain, in the sense whether we're talking mercantilism or later developments, unfortunately, tends to sometimes come from people in the private sector. So they come up with things, you know, ways for the government to protect them, whether it's tariffs or subsidies of various sorts, new government programs. You know, if we just look at what Bush is doing. In his vast looting that's, you know, taking place in New Orleans, I speak, of course, of what the government is going to do to us, the people, for its benefit and the benefit of its special interests. So Halliburton and these companies are going to do very well out of this. Did they have something? You know, how did this? Who came up with this plan of this vast New Deal, New Deal that Bush is this entirely socialist / fascist expansion of state power? With the excuse of the hurricane, was this some guy in HUD or some assistant to Michael Chertoff in Homeland Security? No, I think not. Although there's, you know, movement between businesses, labor unions, universities, and other private institutions, and the government. So it's, you know, so you have people from these institutions going into the government and vice versa. But I think the spark of creativity, in this case, creativity for evil, it does often come from the private sector. It's probably the only criticism one can make of capitalism, that it gives the state the resources to do all the evil things that people within the state and those who are beneficiaries of the state on the outside would like to do. But union was never the threat to us that it was portrayed as, because they couldn't, not because they were good people, they were of course obviously monsters, but they couldn't get it together economically. It was always a third world disaster. I mean, the Soviet Union always had a very small economy. Everybody was very poor there, despite the fact that they were portrayed as, of course, 10 feet tall, as if one famous book put it.
Well, also I'm reminded of, Dick Cheney and Halliburton again. If he had gone in, say, 1997 and asked the shareholders of Halliburton, hey, let's all raise $300 billion and invade Iraq, they would have fired him in a day. But once he becomes vice president, now he can do Halliburton's dirty work with our Marine Corps.
Yeah, and it's of course, it's more than Halliburton, right? I mean, the Pentagon loves it, and the merchants of death, as they used to be called in early in the last century, the munitions manufacturers, the military-industrial complex, they love it. And it's also the military-industrial academic complex. I mean, this is all throughout the universities as well as Lockheed and Martin Marietta and all those companies. And then, of course, these days we have Blackwater and all the other mercenary companies that are doing very, very well, the providers of the so-called security contractors in Iraq. And also I'm told they're active in New Orleans, although I haven't seen that in the mainstream press. So there's a whole vast complex of institutions and organizations that benefit from something like the war in Iraq. And there's another psychological aspect to it. Most of us are perfectly filled. We've got enough to do trying to run our own lives, work in our own institutions, our own business, going to school, whatever else we're doing, raising our families. We're not interested in running anybody else's life or anybody else's town or anybody else's country. But the people who do want to do that go into the government.
Right. All right. Hold it right there, Lou. Everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Lou Rockwell. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Lou Rockwell from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And we're talking about demunicipalizing garbage service. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. We're talking about the warfare state. And, Lou, before the break, you were talking about how most regular people are not interested in going around sticking a gun to somebody's head or even blowing it off. And yet, in the run-up to war, and even today, there are all kinds of people, millions and millions of people, who are regular middle-class folks who I presume ought to be the constituency of Mises.org and LouRockwell.com, and yet they are completely pro-war. And they talk about George Bush as though he's Jesus Christ walking on earth. How? Why?
Well, there's been an unfortunate current of thought in America really ever since the Puritans landed here. And it's identified with the Yankees, and it's the view, if you read the writings of the Pilgrim Fathers, it was their view that they were, that their colony and this new society in America was a new Zion, a new Israel, that they were a new chosen people, that they had a special relationship with God that no other people had. And this is why they felt perfectly happy in slaughtering all the Indians, for example. And you read their writings, and they talk about, hey, it was great, we killed everybody, and it was a great thing. I see this even, there are even regional differences. I mean, I live in Alabama. The typical person in Alabama is not really interested in running everybody in Massachusetts, but the typical guy in Massachusetts is frequently interested in running everybody in Alabama. So there's that, but this Yankee mindset of running everybody else's life, running everybody else in this country, and now running everybody else in the world is taken over, and Bush is a direct ideological and religious descendant of this view, And it's true that the people who are members of the Bush religion see him as some sort of anointed of God. It's very scary business that he can actually talk to God, as of course we can all talk to God, but that God will tell him what to do, and he can know what God is telling him, that he can ask God, should I invade Iraq, which is one of the things he says he did. And God will tell him, yes, go ahead and invade Iraq. So needless to say, I don't believe God told him to do that. I have a different kind of religion. I think that the peacemakers who were blessed, not the war makers. But in the Bush religion, it's just the reverse. It's the war makers who were blessed. And it's a very scary business. Of course, some of these people believe that it's a good thing to bring on Armageddon. It'll bring the second coming of Jesus Christ and bring them to power. They believe that there'll be a period of 1,000 years after the second coming of Christ where they will be dictators of the whole earth. And they'll live well, very well, and they'll be the ruling class, and everybody will be as a footstool under their feet. So there's, to the extent Bush actually believes all this stuff, one always has to slightly worry that he's on the margin less concerned about preserving human life on this planet and less concerned about a nuclear war and what that might mean. We see them right now threatening to... saying that, warning everybody, by the way, we can use nuclear weapons on you, whether you've used them on us. We can use it just if we're suspicious you might do something bad to us or somebody else. We're free to murder you all if we feel it's in our interest. And I don't know, it impresses me as about the state of the foreign policy of Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan, and everybody has an ideology, right? It's not just power. There's always an ideology that justifies all of this. And Genghis Khan believed that the gods had given him the earth to rule, and so that if you were opposing him, you were engaged in an act of rebellion against the gods as well as against him. And therefore, anything could be done to you. You had obviously no right to life or anything else. So somehow, there are aspects of the U.S. Foreign policy establishment today and military establishment seem to take the view that really, the U.S. is a special deal that has rights that no other country has, can tell everybody else what to do, and if anybody resists, why, that's terrorism, right? We can invade your country, we can occupy your country, we can install our own government, we can do whatever we want to you, and if you resist, you're a terrorist. Well, you know, maybe some of them are terrorists, but not everybody in that situation is a terrorist. I keep thinking that if anybody were to, even if it was a freer country than ours, were to invade our country, and they're a different race, a different religion, they're a different, they speak a different language, they have a different history, they're different in everywhere, and they're telling us what to do. At least in the South, the average young guy would be taking the rifle and going out in the woods. They would not be saluting and obeying. And would they be terrorists in that case, even if it was, say, Switzerland that had taken us over, a freer country, or Hong Kong or whatever had taken us over? But we somehow assume that anybody who resists the U.S. is resisting God. And therefore, anything can be done to them. They can be nuked. Their cities can be wiped. We can use biological warfare, chemical warfare, anything. The only time WMDs are bad is when they're used by somebody else without our permission, or might be used by somebody else.
Now, see, it's not a surprise to me at all that this is the point of view of the state. But I guess the part that really bothers me is when my next-door neighbor thinks that way. Like, what is it about this philosophy that the average person who in every way stands only to lose gets on board with this program?
Well, part of it's, part of it's religion. Part of it is an unfortunate aspect of human nature, right? I mean, too many people, even if they don't want to engage in it personally, are happy to cheer on bloodshed.
Right, war is a force that gives us meaning, right?
Yeah, great book, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a very disturbing thing, and it's why, on the other hand, it's evil. And the great achievement of classical liberalism, that is the ancestor of libertarianism, was to put all the things that in the days of the Caesars and the Pharaohs had been perfectly normal. The government is appointed by God, or is God, and if it wants to slit everybody's throat in some other country, they deserve it. And hey, let's have fun. Put them in the have them eaten alive by tigers in the Coliseum, and we'll all enjoy it. And it's a great time. It was I would say this is actually Christianity, but also classical liberalism that put all this sort of stuff under a moral cloud. Whether it's war, whether it's slavery, whether it's authoritarianism, totalitarianism, the idea that that government, that the moral rules don't apply to government. They're in the wrong, and this is why, of course, they want to censor, suppress any dissident on especially the war and peace question. It's why any government in a period of war wants to shut everybody up who's going to question them, because the proponents of peace are in the right and the proponents of mass murder are in the wrong. And yes, it's true that some people will support this. Fewer people will support it in the long term. But, yeah, there's a part of human life, you know, human character for some people that it's like a football game and they're cheering on our team to, you know, kill the other team, except they really are killing the other team. And, of course, in a case like Iraq, I mean, it's just a total act of aggression. I think I try to remember, which apparently nobody else does, that the first charge at the Nuremberg trials was the first crime against humanity that was charged was waging aggressive war. And I think we can certainly hope everybody listening to this show can agree, waging aggressive war is wrong. But, you know, if we can put sort of the ethics of libertarianism in a nutshell and all the other theories in another nutshell, it's that we think that the state is subject to the moral law, whereas the state itself and the justifiers of the state believe it is above the moral law, that the moral law does not apply to it. We think that if something's kidnapping, it's wrong, and it doesn't matter whether they call it the draft and some guys in a uniform are doing it, it's still evil. That theft is evil even if you're working for the tax police. That mass murder is evil, or murder is evil, mass murder more evil, even if you're, you know, wearing an Army uniform or in an Air Force uniform dropping an atomic bomb on a defenseless city full of civilian refugees.
It really does make all the difference, doesn't it, when you apply the individual crime term to, you know, conscription is kidnapping. Oh.
You know, this is why libertarianism is such a powerful thing, because once you take that point of view, first of all, everything changes. The way you look at history, the way you look at current events, everything that's on the news, everything is cast in a different light. And this is what the state and the media that's connected with the state, and academia that's connected with the state, big business and big labor and so forth that's connected with the state, this is what they fear the most, because, of course, they are all criminals. And they're engaged in what in private society is correctly seen as criminal activity. But we're all taught from the earliest days in the government schools that it's, you know, different with the government. So the government is not concerned with the, you know, messy, nasty private individual interests like we are. They're concerned with, you know, much higher goals, the national good, the common good, the national defense, and the rest of the eyewash. But, of course, it's all just cover for theft and killing, and there's, you know, we talked about people who enjoy this sort of stuff. They go into the government. And so, you know, as Randolph Bourne said, war is not only the health of the state, it's actually the fun of the state. It's the joy of the state. They love it. They love this kind of thing, just like they love, for example, ordering people out of a city. They love it. They love ordering everybody, get out of your home, leave your home, you're out of here by 6 o'clock, move out. They love that stuff. The normal person, of course, would not want to do that. Even if he had the power to do it, he wouldn't want the power to do it. But there are people who want the power to do it, and they staff the concentration camps, and they staff the every other aspect of the modern national state.
Right. I mean, I know if I was a criminal, well, a smart one, I would go work for government rather than having them chase me around all day. I mean, if you want to kill people, get
if you're a private criminal, right, there's a chance you'll be arrested. If you're a public criminal, you do the arresting.
Yeah. All right, let me get a little more specific here. You've written a few times on your site and the way you title some of these articles, a few different times I've noticed the phrase, it's a heck of a note to have to root for the Rockefellers. And I wonder if you could explain that to me while you're running for the Rockefeller.
Well, because I'm being ironic, right? But I'm not a fan of, you know, if we think of the Rockefeller as just being sort of shorthand for the old interventionist establishment that we saw committing huge crimes. I mean, so this is goes back to the 19th century, but sort of what the ideological point of view that might be connected with, say, the Council on Foreign Relations, the idea that the U.S. government should be, in some sense, running the world for the purposes of big business and power and glory. But I meant that there's another aspect. There are another class of state intellectuals that are called neoconservatives. This is their own name, although they now try to say that you're a bad guy if you use that name. But this was their own name for themselves, new conservatives. And I think that's actually a crazy gene. I mean, I think they're actually nuts in addition to being evil. So it's a very scary thing if they've got their finger on the trigger. And they certainly had a lot to do with promoting the war in Iraq. I don't think they were entirely responsible. After all, imperialism has existed for a very long time, long before there were neoconservatives. But they had a role in this war. They were promoting the invasion of Iraq long before 9/11 in various think tank papers, and certainly George W. Bush was promoting it long before 9/11. There's in David Frum's a neoconservative speechwriter for Bush, and his book about his year in the White House talks about the first meeting that Bush had with the speechwriters in February 2001, and he said this administration is dedicated to the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. Again, you know, they tried to say this had something to do with use the excuse of 9/11, but now they're calling for a war against Iran. They want to have a war against Syria. Syria, the last Arab state where you can get a drink, where Islamic fundamentalists are not running things. The previous one was Iraq, and now of course we've got the fundamentalists running things under the U.S. aegis, and it's a very scary business. This is potential world war that they're playing with, and I think they're crazy. I mean, there's a crazy aspect to their ideology, and it seems to me obvious. And when I see any of them speaking, it seems to me there's a nutso question to them, as well as the typical statist intellectual, war intellectual. I remember Herman Kahn, who now dead, who was a very important war and intellectual early neocon. At the Hudson Institute and the Pentagon, Rand Institute, and all the various warfare state think tanks, but who wrote in a book called Thinking the Unthinkable, and he wrote a number of books and papers on this subject. He said the U.S. must, you know, make regular use of atomic weapons. The only way to really run the world is to both threaten and to use atomic weapons when necessary, and that it was a terrible thing that we'd stopped using atomic weapons after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So they almost seems to be a even more of a reveling in killing and on the other hand, there are fatal flaws in these people, and we see it in Iraq. They believe that everything, that force and violence can achieve everything. The gun can achieve everything, but of course it can't. The gun, there are things that can't be achieved with the gun. There's things that there's a great book called The Rise and Decline of the State by Martin Van Creveld, who's a Israeli military historian, not a libertarian, but this is one of the great books I've ever read, and it's published by Cambridge University Press, and he talks about the rise of the nation state after the Treaty of Westphalia and then the decline of it since World War II and why that is. But he talks about why state armies can't compete with private armies, and of course that's pretty much what we have going on in Iraq. One side has, you know, a $500 billion military budget and spy satellites and every kind of, you know, fantastic technology and airplanes and tanks and you know, drones and everything that the government can steal and loot from the private sector and use for its own purposes is there. And then you've got a bunch of other guys, you know, got improvised explosives and they've got old rifles and so forth, and yet they're able to, as a guerrilla operation, beat the occupation. The U.S. had lost the war in Iraq. Nobody wants to say that, and obviously in the public print, but, I mean, the war is lost. The only question is, you know, how many more people are going to be killed on both sides before we admit that and leave.
I'm Scott Horton. This is the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm talking with Lou Rockwell from LouRockwell.com and Mises.org. We'll be right back. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. We're wrapping up with Lou Rockwell, unfortunately, too, because I got another couple hours worth of questions here. But I want to start this little segment with an anecdote. One day I went to antiwar.com, and there was an article titled The National Defense Myth. And even before I clicked on it, I cursed out loud because I knew what was waiting for me there. It was the death of my last excuse for having a government at all. And it was an article written by my guest, Lou Rockwell, reviewing the new book by Hans Hermann Hoppe, The Myth of National Defense. And, Lou, you destroyed my last excuse for having a government.
Well, not I, right? I mean, I'm just simply repeating what great men have shown before me, obviously Murray Rothbard in particular, but Gustav de Molinari first in the 19th century, and Hans Hoppe, recently Frank Chodorov, I mean, many, many others. This is probably the worst reason to have a government, is war. Because war is, you know, even as Mises pointed out, even a just war waged justly and forced upon you that you win is a disaster. It's a disaster because not only because it consumes resources and kills people, but it empowers your own state. Thereby, everybody loses from war. So even if it's, you know, forced, as again, you know, forced on you and you don't wage it unjustly, which is pretty rare these days, still it's always very bad.
Well, you know, today is Constitution Day. And in your book, Speaking of Liberty, you talk about the ratification of the Constitution being a big mistake. We should have just gone ahead and stuck with the articles, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the articles were perfect, but I think they were far better than the Constitution. Hoppe points out that every single time a Constitution is adopted, and remember this going on in Iraq right now, it always represents a step up in central government power, and that was certainly true in our own country. And if you read the anti-federalists, whether it's the so-called anti-federalists, so often happens the bad guys adopted the good guy name and then branded the good guys as being against the good thing. So the actual Federalists, that is those people who believed in decentralization of power, were the people who opposed the adoption of the Constitution. But the most centralizing big government people of the time called themselves Federalists, and they called the people who were for real federalism the Anti-Federalists. So this is a frequent thing in history. But if you read the Anti-Federalists, if you read, there's a number of great books. There's one called The Anti-Federalist Papers. You read these guys, everything they say came true. Everything they say about how the Supreme Court is going to be tyrannical, everything they say about what the federal government is going to end up doing, it all comes true. And it's not that nobody could see these things. And the Federalist Papers, which we're all taught to think of as somehow holy writ, are a bunch of lying political pamphlets designed to impose this bigger, more centralized government on the country. And, of course, successfully. And I just finished rereading, after many, many years, Albert J. Knox's Mr. Jefferson, which I highly recommend. It's a short biographical essay on Jefferson, maybe 120 or 30 pages. Really, it's the best thing on Jefferson. And one of the things Knox shows, reminds us of, is that the people in the Constitutional Convention were all heavily invested in paper from the previous regime, and they wanted a constitution so it would pay off all their debts at 100 cents on the dollar, and that's indeed what they got what they got to happen. So there were special interests at work there, as always.
Right, yeah, and the people in Iraq are paying for it right now, and we are too.
Well, it's also worth looking at this Iraqi constitution And, of course, it's difficult to read the whole thing. It's very, very long. But the
great.
Key thing is that every time it says there's a right, it says, as you know, except as provided by law.
Right.
You have the total right to freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of liberty and association and so forth, except as provided by law.
Right.
So, in other words, there's no freedom at all.
Right. All right. Well, we're all out of time. I'm sorry. That's the case. It's been an honor to talk with you today, sir.